We live in amazing times. We can experience the grandeur and the awesome nature of the planet in new ways, thanks to the incredible work of cinematographers and the totally amazing internet. I hope it's, this technology has come in time for us to realize the beauty of the planet that we inhabit before we've destroyed it. We're destroying it, as you know, at an amazing rate. We are seeing the incredible beauty of our home planet as no generation before us has ever seen it. If I had the time, I might have chosen clips from a number of videos that perhaps would even do a better representation of the best of our planet. The BBC series The Blue Planet comes to mind. My topic in this sermon is Revelation, and I intentionally, as I said, chose a wordless video to begin. The point I hope to make this morning is the importance of the experience in Revelation, beyond the words. This morning I'll suggest that Revelation for Unitarian Universalists must be experienced. In the words of Jesus that we sang a little while ago, we're obligated to seek and to knock and to ask. This personal experience, this obligation on the individual to be actively seeking, knocking, and asking is not the traditional route to Revelation. Our ancestors for millennia relied on sages and seers and prophets and reports of direct revelation from God for their understanding of reality and the role that they were to play in the world. From the time of the ancient Greeks to the last non-Christian Roman emperor, insight into the nature of reality, and in particular the best course to take in planning for your future, was gained from oracles. The most famous of these was Pythia, any one of the many female priests who spoke from the Temple of Delphi in Greece over a period spanning more than 1,000 years. The Greek oracles lost their grip on Revelation around 300 of the Common Era when Christianity became the religion of the Roman Empire. But the masses of humanity in Europe and Asia still rely on scriptures as old or older than the oracles to shape their view of reality. It wasn't until the 17th century that the beginning of what we now call the Enlightenment that the adoption of the scientific method presented a real alternative. That rational scientific approach to revelation is now the dominant social force in the Western world. Throughout all of human history, though, there's been another strain of revelation, and that's the individual direct experience of a transcending reality that we sometimes dismissively refer to as the mystical. Earth-centered religions, such as those of indigenous peoples of North America, were more experience-based, less reliant on ancient texts. And there'll be more on this later. I'd like to continue this morning by picking up on some ideas expressed last week, specifically the work of psychologist Jonathan Haidt. He builds on the ideas of Steven Pinker in his 2002 bestseller, The Blank Slate. Haidt and his colleagues have studied moral values across cultures and concluded that we're born with a predisposition to five moral values. You might remember they were care for others, fairness and equity, two particularly liberal values, and respect for authority, group loyalty, and sanctity or purity, which tend to be three conservative values. Steven Pinker makes a much more general case for the innate nature of intellect and personalities. He cites several different studies supporting his claim that we're born with individual personalities and intellectual capabilities. We've all heard about identical twins who were separated at birth and who met as adults to find that they dress alike, like the same foods, work in the same fields, etc. Pinker cites case studies of identical twins raised in different families to conclude that all the experience that we have in our homes all the parental guidance that we experience has no identifiable effect on intellect or personality. That despite all the effort parents put into trying to train their children to behave a certain way.
Or outcome.
So you get the feeling that they didn't have to do these studies. They just had to talk to a few parents and grandparents and would have had this explained. So Pinker concludes that it's not parenting, but our genes. And the culture that we're raised in, particularly the effects of our peer group. And chance, in the form of in utero brain development and the chance events that shape our lives. The point here is that we come into this amazing world predisposed to be receptive to some revelations more than others. There is, I believe, some truth in the often heard report from people who discover Unitarian Universalism that they think they were actually born Unitarian Universalists. They just didn't realize it until they found us. So we come into the world with our character, our personality, our moral compass. In the words of neurologist Gary Marcus, we come organized in advance of experience. Nature provides a first draft, which we then build on and modify with our experience. This pre-programming is genetic, the result of our evolutionary history. In a strictly scientific worldview, we're born into a competitive world where our genetic inheritance, including our character and our personality and our moral compass, are finely tuned by our evolutionary history to make us fit for the world. Now, if in the process of competing with other life, we eliminate a bunch of other species, that's really of no consequence, provided that it does not hurt our own survival. The natural world is all about survival, procreation, and the passing along of genetic material. In this process, according to some theories, we killed off our closest competitor, the human Neanderthal species, some 30 to 40,000 years ago, barely a blink in evolutionary time. But there are other ways to look at our lives. And for me, this begins with taking the bigger, grander view of the experience that we're born into. This universe is amazingly diverse and complicated. At its basic level, it's a web of energy and matter, a web that we really can't perceive. We only perceive very small portions of reality. The initial energy at the moment of creation, along with a few simple laws that we can express now in mathematical form, make the entire experience of life on this planet and the infinite number of other planets possible. In fact, make it inevitable. For our entire human history, we've tried to explain why this amazing universe exists. And despite claims to the contrary, we have failed entirely. We can explain how the universe functions, we can explain how it evolved, but we cannot explain why it should exist at all. Stephen Hawking and others have made claims that they can explain the existence of the universe given the laws of physics. But no one can explain why there should be these elegant laws of physics. Laws that logically must have existed independent of the universe as we know it. So the point of the introductory video and my inadequate attempts to describe this mystery of creation that we live in is that we experience a special kind of revelation that transcends language when we immerse ourselves in the experience of life. That video image of planet Earth hanging in space, or that aerial shot of Angel Falls in Venezuela, as spectacular as they are no more powerful than the real life experiences that we have. Letting waves wash over our toes on a beach in Nova Scotia, or watching a wild flicker feeding on suet hung from a tree in our backyard. If we're open to these experiences, they are as amazing as the ones that you saw in the video. We have Kim Turner to thank for the picture that we were looking at earlier, her skills as a photographer, with pictures from her backyard or from many familiar places in Halifax, amaze me and take me to a place of mystical appreciation for the world around me. I suppose that our ability to experience life and the world around us as a mystical experience, it may be one of those innate inborn characteristics that Steven Pinker was talking about. But this genetic pre-programming must be reinforced by our experience. We need to develop and nurture our ability through our spiritual practices. We need to do that in order to experience nature and the world in a transcendent way. And it isn't just the beautiful experience of nature that opens our hearts to a mystical experience of life. The death of a parent, as we've heard today, or a close friend, or a spouse, can arouse in us an aching appreciation for the incredible experience of life. So precise, so precious, so short, so fragile. Somehow, we become conscious beings in this beautiful, terrifying, nurturing, punishing, and brutal world. We come with an innate set of values. We live for a very short time, and then we must leave. In our brief time here, we learn, we receive revelations. As Sir James Sire has said, truth cannot be constructed. Truth can only be revealed. We cannot be creators, only receptors of truth. So what then is the difference between receiving a revelation and figuring something out for yourself? For some, it's sufficient to receive revelation secondhand. Someone else has been told the truth, and for some, that's enough. But for you, the Christian disciple Thomas holds a special place. You'll recall the story of doubting Thomas, who told the other disciples that he would not believe that Christ had risen until he could put my finger in the mark of the nails and my hand in his side. And after Jesus had allowed him to do this, Jesus said, "Have you believed because you have seen me? Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have come to believe." Thomas experienced the revelation firsthand. Most UUs, like Thomas, insist on that experience of revelation. I was discussing this recently with my colleagues, Christian colleagues, and one of them commented that, you know, doubting Thomas gets a bad rap just because he, you know, wanted reassurance. He's been known as doubting Thomas ever since, and that's a shame. And actually, I think doubting Thomas is not a pejorative term. It's a compliment. So, Unitarian Universalists have adopted a statement of our sources in Revelation. When I'm working for the theme on Revelation, it seemed appropriate that we should look at where we claim to get our revelation as a faith tradition. I've included a copy in your order of service this morning. You can also pick up a wallet card by the front door of the church that includes our principles as well as our sources. And I think it's good to know that they're also printed in your hymnal, just before the first hymn in the hymnal are principles and sources. This is where we claim to get our revelation. So I think it's enlightening now to take a look at those sources. The first of them is direct experience of that transcending mystery and wonder affirmed in all cultures, which moves us to a renewal of the spirit and an openness to the forces which create and uphold life. This is our first source, and it speaks to that mystical, transcendent, and personal experience of reality. Our first source is definitely something you must experience personally. Second source, words and deeds of prophetic men and women which challenge us to confront powers and structures of evil with justice, compassion, and the transforming power of love. Note here that what is important about these revelations is that they challenge us individually. The words and deeds of others in this life are another example of how the universe is challenging us. to respond. Third, the wisdom from the world's religions which inspire us in our ethical and spiritual life. Again, the revelations of other world religions are a source of revelation to us only to the extent that they inspire us. Fourth, Jewish and Christian teachings which call us to respond to God's love by loving our neighbors as ourselves. It's not all Jewish and Christian teachings that we take as sources. It's only those that call us, that speak to us, that resonate with our experience of this life. Fifth, humanist teachings which counsel us to heed the guidance of reason and the results of science, and that warn us against idolatries of mind and spirit. Here we are counseled. Here we are warned. But we must choose to respond. It's only a revelation to the extent that we accept that counsel and that guidance. And sixth, spiritual teachings of earth-centered traditions which celebrate the sacred circle of life and instruct us to live in harmony with the rhythms of nature. This source requires that we understand that we experience the sacred circle of life and the rhythms of nature directly. So I'll sum up now by saying that for me, revelation is the result of my experience of life. Life in this incredible universe. A universe that challenges me, that inspires me, that calls me to respond, and calls me to celebrate. My universe is always asking me questions, always testing my resolve, always challenging my willingness to follow that inborn moral compass. It's up to us to choose how we respond to the challenges of global warming, for example, to the scandal of the treatment of the First Nations people in our history. It's up to us to choose how we respond to the panhandler standing outside Tim Hortons. These are all part of the universe asking us questions. These are all the ultimate source of our revelation. May it be so, and amen.